Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're about to join us for this episode of This Week in Law, where I'm joined by two of my favorite interns for This Week in Law, a good representation of our intern family. Emery Roan is here, fresh off the bar exam, and Matt Curtis is here with me, too. We're going to talk about the podcasting patent, Ding Dong, It Is Dead, or Is It Jon Snow? An $125 dispute that wound up in $1 million in damages in a lawsuit. Class actions, gotta catch them all. And neural networks galore, next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 395, recorded August 11th, 2017. Outsourcing Bias and Whales. Hi, folks, it's Denise Howell, and yay, we're all in the family here on this week's episode of This Week in Law, because my family, well, not my entire family, but a chunk of my family of wonderful interns on the show are here today on the show. Matt Curtis is here. He is a law student at Notre Dame. Hello, Matt. Great to see you.
Hi, great to see you, and great to be here with Emery.
I know. It is great to be here with Emery Roan, who was on the show quite often until he had to hunker down and take the bar exam, which he has now come out from under. Hello, Emery. Great to see you.
Hey, Denise. Hey, Matt. It is a pleasure to be back. I can't tell you how great it feels to have that hopefully behind me.
Yes. Hopefully. All our fingers are crossed. Do you still have to wait till November to find out?
Yeah. $800 test. Wait 4 months to get the results. Whatever. I'm not bitter.
Yes. That hasn't changed. That hasn't changed since I took the California bar, and they let you know Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah, so, exactly. Friday before Thanksgiving, just in case, you know, maybe it's not awkward enough to be surrounded by your family members while you're waiting on this huge decision. What could possibly go wrong with that?
Exactly.
But I got the two-day bar, so, you know, there's that at least.
Yes, mine was 3 days long and an agonizing 3 days they were. Before we go on and get into our stories, they always say you shouldn't talk about the bar exam after the bar exam because it just drives you crazy. You certainly shouldn't talk about it with people who took it with you, because if you start comparing notes and seeing that they got a different answer than you got, it drives both of you crazy. One of you may have
got... how you lose law school friends.
Exactly. So we won't ask you to... tell us the substance of anything that you submitted on the bar exam, Emery. But I'm just curious whether, you know, in today's day and age, technology and all the things that we talk about here on the show made its way in any way, shape, or form onto the California bar.
I could talk about some stuff. Actually, I don't think I can talk about the specifics of the questions. I'm pretty sure those are some locked up IP from the Bar Association, and they do not want you to talk about it. But... No, there was nothing interesting, no exciting technology questions. It was all exactly like what Barbary questions have been for, you know, 20 years. I do want to, you know, put this out to any of our other law student listeners or people that are thinking about law school. You know, the bar is terrifying, and the industry and the school and Barbary will do a great job of instilling that terror in you. But at the same time, taking the bar, it's incredibly demystifying, you know, especially with the 2 day bar. I think that I'm incredibly lucky for being in the 2 day bar, not the 3 day bar, but especially for 2 days, it's just a big test. It's just a big test. You take it for 2 days. If you've done the preparation, you're not going to be caught off guard probably. And you know, it's just a big test. You can do it. You've done tests like this all your life. It's not the end of the world. If you don't pass it this time, you'll definitely pass it the next time. So good luck, everyone. And congratulations to all my fellow students that have just, or juris doctors that have just finished taking it.
Yes.
Enjoy your vacation.
Congratulations to all of you. For the time being, Emery is a 2017 fellow for the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, an organization that we're big fans of here on the show. Do you ever get back east and attend any of their events, Emery?
I haven't yet. There, yeah, you know, it's I've been taking the bar, but you know, I definitely want to spend some time with him, get to some of the meetups. There might be a podcast in the works. It's definitely some cool stuff to keep tuned to.
That's awesome. Yes, and definitely take some time and just unplug and relax and chill, because you've got till November. So one of the things you've been doing, and we'll talk about this more throughout the show, is playing around with neural networks.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a blog post hopefully coming up tonight or tomorrow after I finish the NPRE. But neural networks, there's a really great tutorial on a blog post I linked to earlier this week or last week about, you know, if you have any kind of experience with a terminal, I think that basically anyone can play around with neural nets, and it's a lot of fun. I published an article about, I guess a blog post, about I fed Law 360's list of the 400 or 500 largest law firms into a neural net and got it to spit out some interesting, fictitious, unique law firm names. And I'm doing the same thing with podcasts right now. So I'm trying to name my next podcast using a neural net, and I think the results are going to be fun.
Good. We're going to talk about those more specifically later in the show, because you're teasing our resource of the week right now. But we can talk about neural nets in the context of monkey selfies. What? How does that work? It's all under the rubric of copyright. So I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. I don't know if everyone has heard, but the monkey selfie case is poised to settle. We may not get a decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, who heard oral argument in the case a couple of weeks ago. The parties have asked the Ninth Circuit to hold off on ruling because they are close to reaching an out-of-court settlement. So the settlement would make the ruling unnecessary, and the ruling might actually harm the party's ability to come to a settlement. The speculation on all this is that PETA is seeing the light, that the argument did not go well for PETA, and that PETA is now staring down the barrel of potentially having to pay the photographers and blurbs attorney's fees for making them go through this lawsuit, which given a couple of years plus of litigation can be considerable. We're thinking, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars are potentially on the line there. So if the parties can reach a settlement, one of the common things that would go into such a settlement is the waiver of the right to pursue attorney's fees. So this is all just, you know, inside baseball legal speculation, but the case may go away. What do you think of all this, Matt?
I think it's interesting from a PR perspective. I wouldn't want a settlement coming out that, or an award for attorney's fees coming out if I was PETA. I would guess that it would inhibit their ability to raise funding to some degree. But you know, and settling it out of court, even if they're paying as much, may be better for them. I don't know how they didn't see this coming. I don't know how they thought they were going to get standing.
Right. It is a tough, tough issue for them in the case, as the Ninth Circuit made clear at the oral argument. Emery, any thoughts?
I mean, I think you basically said it right. It's, this is such a bizarre, ridiculous situation that we don't even know if Naruto is the right Naruto. You know, this clearly probably should have been settled a long time ago. But, you know, I think it's interesting if they are going to settle that they're giving up attorney's fees, which I imagine are going to be very considerable. So the monkey selfie case never dies.
No, it will go on in our hearts. It will go on and on. and possibly, you know, these issues just don't just go away because this lawsuit goes away. And one of the ways that they can come up and may come up in the future are, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago when we sort of unpacked the oral argument before the Ninth Circuit, is that a lot of these issues do apply to creative works, created by things other than humans. So it's not just animals. And of course, you've been playing around creating things with neural nets, Emery, and you're not the only one. There is a listener, Ken H., sent in this great video. We're going to play a couple of clips. It harkens back to the discussion we had on the show probably over a year ago now, where when No Man's Sky was poised to come out, and we were fascinated by the fact that No Man's Sky has music that is created on the fly by an AI in the game to go along with the gameplay, and what are the ramifications of that. Video game manufacturers are not the only people creating music using a neural net or some sort of artificially intelligent agent. So we'll play you a bit of this video and then talk about it on the other end.
I'm Yotam. This is an experiment called AI Duet. It uses machine learning to let you play a duet with the computer. Making music using code isn't a new thing at all, but machine learning gives us a different way to go about it. If I was trying to make AI Duet with more traditional programming, I'd have to write out lots of rules, like if someone plays a C, maybe respond by going up to a G. Or if someone plays three ascending notes, then maybe go back down. I'd basically be creating this map to tell the computer how to make these decisions, but there are just too many note and timing combinations to map it all by hand. This experiment approaches the problem differently, using machine learning, specifically neural networks. We played the computer tons of examples of melodies. Over time, it learns these fuzzy relationships between notes and timings and builds its own map based on the examples it's given. So in this experiment, you play a few notes. They go to the neural net, which basically decides, based on those notes and all the examples it's been given, some possible responses. I had some friends try it out. It was fun to see how it responds to different things people play. It picks up on stuff like key and rhythm that you're implying, even though I never explicitly programmed in the concepts of key and rhythm. It was cool to see people use it in ways I didn't expect. Instead of taking turns, a few people.
I think we get the idea, Victor. Thank you very much. So this is really cool. He does go on to point out that he's using open source tools provided by Google to have this interaction with the neural net and the musicians. So if you want to do similar things, watch the whole video. There's information at the end. Of course, this and everything else we're discussing today is in our publicly available discussion points at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're on episode 395 this week. So, Emery, robot artists, copyright protection. What do you think about this issue? And should there be, we've all sort of been skewering PETA for having brought their suit, but is it an easy analysis? Who should have the copyright in something that a neural net, for example, has created?
I don't think it's necessarily an easy analysis, but I will say that, you know, when I was reading about and talking about No Man's Sky, you know, a year ago, and when I was, you know, thinking about neural net and AI generated music, you know, before, I definitely was more willing to think that the question of, you know, is this an actual AI generating is and should the AI be awarded copyrights, was, I will say that working with neural nets, you get an appreciation for how much input the human has on it. And, you know, that's not as simple as just let me take all of this stuff and put it in this black box and it's going to spit out art. And then, you know, yeah, that black box magically created art and it's creative and is, you know, deserving of protection. For example, by the way, just to, you know, everyone should check out this Project Magenta project that we just linked to. You can play around with it online. You don't have to download anything. If you want to just tap away at your keyboard, you know, you can produce some pretty cool results. But if you look at the blog post that I wrote about creating these law firm names, there's a lot of fiddling with, you know, parameters and, you know, configuring exactly how the neural net is spitting out results so that it doesn't just spit out complete noise, or you can sort of trick it into giving some semblance of meaning. So that if you read through there, there's, you know, the temperature is what you mess with, and what I messed with in this article, where if you make it a low temperature, it's not very, you know, quote unquote novel or creative, and is instead relying more heavily on the data that you provide it, versus if you give it a high temperature, it's far more out there and, you know, more noisy. And so, it, you know, you get an appreciation that, you know, it's much more of a collaborative effort, and probably more than that, that the creator is the human that's just sort of providing the parameters for this black box to work. So, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot. Like, do I have any kind of copyright protections for this, these lists that I'm generating? I mean, first of all, we know that names aren't copyrightable, but like the body of work might be. And I would consider that my input in that is probably considerable. You know, for the past week, I've been working on an update to that article that's doing podcast names. And to do that, I had to collect data on, you know, massive amounts of podcast names, which involved literally hours of pretty painfully copying and pasting from the iTunes web directory, putting into a spreadsheet, organizing the data, cleaning it up so that it would work with the programs correctly. You know, I've spent many hours trying to get this project to spit out something that looks like it resembles podcast names. And, you know, I can imagine that this neural net creator or the, you know, programmer that created this, you know, duet or improvisational, you know, keyboarding player would probably claim a fair bit of ownership as well. You know, I don't imagine it's as simple as he just pressed a button and suddenly this AI can spit out art. But yeah, I don't think it's a simple question either. You know, somewhere along the line, you can imagine that this is going to get very creative. And I think at that point, it becomes far more interesting than Naruto, because there might actually be some sort of intention behind the algorithm.
Well, here's where Naruto comes back into it, because the question that remains outstanding, even if the parties settle this case, the monkey selfie case, and go away, is we don't have settled law in the United States over whether there is copyright in this image that the monkey took with the photographer's camera when it stole it, or whether there is no copyright, whether it's in the public domain, which is what the Wikimedia Foundation contends. So I'm thinking that there could be similar issues or a similar difference of opinion with computer generated works as well. Either someone owns the copyright or no one owns the copyright. And that's kind of a big demarcation, kind of a big thing to have a split about, disagreement about.
I totally agree. You know, if the case is that, I think it's really problematic to think that, for example, I could own all the copyrighted, you know, or I could have a copyright on the content that I create using a neural net, because, you know, as much work as I put into it, I was then eventually able to just write out a line in a terminal, press enter, wait 5 minutes, and then generated literally a list of 200,000 different names. And it's like, okay, well, like I don't know in that. Like, I can't preclude someone from using that any name, you know, that they arrive on happenstance. And in fact, by the way, when I generated that list, This Week in Law was one of the names that was generated just completely. So, you know, like, it's interesting. I don't think it's a clear cut. And I think that it is going to become more complicated.
Enough monkeys at a typewriter and you get This Week in Law.
Yeah. Well, enough monkeys with the right training set. You know, someone posted out in the chat that, you know, it's incredibly dependent upon the training set. And of course, I meant to mention that. But yeah, you know, it's these neural nets are dependent upon what you put into it. I think someone else said that neural nets are a technology to
to remember things.
To remember things. Yeah, I'll come up with it later.
Yes. Matt, anything to add about
to outsource bias?
There we go.
Neural networks are technology to outsource bias.
Ooh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's an excellent observation. Matt, anything to say about the possible demise of the Monkey Selfie lawsuit or the possible rise of machines with copyrights?
Yeah, in terms of like the neural network that something like Emory is talking about, I think the analogy the best use is something like a photograph. Like clearly, you know, if I'm working with a modern day DSLR, like the image that I'm able to take with that machine, obviously neural networks are working on a different programming basis, but the output that I'm getting is far beyond the work that I put in. But the originality requirement is still that I'm is still captured in the viewing taken by the individual. So as it stands, I think that the law is still homocentric and will likely remain being so.
Okay. And again, I mean, we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the oral argument, but there are different laws in different countries about this. In the UK and Ireland and New Zealand, computer generated works definitely do have copyright. And that may be the most sensible approach to all of this. And the copyright is residing in the person who did the programming, the person who did the inputs, who created the bias that created the work. You know, in the United States right now, I don't know that we're incredibly settled on that question. So it'll be interesting to watch the law unfold. Emery, anything to add before we move on?
No, I'm trying to think of a good rebuttal to the DSLR analysis, but I can't quite come up with it yet. So I might just send you a DM, Matthew.
Perfect. Just a quick question. When you were using the neural network, did you read through the terms of service and see if they contracted for the copyright in that?
You know, I didn't. It's for our listeners, I'm using Torch RNN, which is a recursive neural network. It's on GitHub. It's open source. I actually didn't see any kind of TOU or at all.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'll try to look into that. Good question.
Yeah, and that is, it's a good thing to bear in mind as you're perhaps using these tools in the creation of various works, whether they're literary or musical or anything else, that if you're using something that is open source like Magenta or Torch, you may have unlimited ability to make use of the works, as assuming that you can actually have copyright in those works. And if you're using something that's not open source, you may have restrictions on you that are built into those terms of service. So pay attention.
So actually, predictably, you know, as a software license, it speaks mostly about the use of the software itself, and it doesn't actually say anything about the resulting content that you generate with it. So again, left up in the air.
Yeah.
Right. And again, the other sort of layer of complexity on that is if you're doing this in your personal capacity or your professional capacity on behalf of an employer, then the work for hire doctrine jumps in, and whatever you're creating may not be yours under those circumstances either. So let's move on. We put a bunch of stories in the rundown this week, Emery, that sort
I just wanted to add one other thing just to that. If you go to the Project Magenta Google page, you know, they are barreling ahead on this question of whether AI can generate music, and it's entirely it's devoted to purely musical applications. So they have like a drum sequencer and some sort of like sketch neural net that, you know, takes what you begin to draw and sketches that out. So I haven't gotten a chance to play with them, but it looks really fun. So I encourage everyone to go check it out.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Hope. And if you do check it out, let us know, you know, what you're planning to do with it, what your thoughts are. Let's move on to some crimes and justice stories. A bunch of stuff in here that sort of pulls back issues we've talked about before. And tells us that those issues are still out there and are developing over time. Let's start out talking about Tor, shall we? Because I think there is, based on various investigations over time, where people who were using Tor have been discovered and prosecuted, there's kind of an open question out there about whether Tor is really still secure, still a way to use the internet and not have your IP address available to law enforcement if they are looking for you. So a new wrinkle on that is laid out in this story by Dan Gooden at Ars Technica. There was a sextortionist, a young man in Bakersfield, California, who was doing the worst kind of activity, trying to convince young women, underaged women, to send him, you know, compromising photographs of themselves and continue sending them, and videos as well. And if they refused to do so, he then started threatening them and their families and their schools, and terrible, terrible stuff. So the FBI is rightly investigating this guy. And as Dan Gooden has reported here, we know how they determined his identity. What they did is they worked with one of the victims who was supposed to, because she was being blackmailed, send a video file to him. And they embedded some code in the video file, which when activated on his end, when the video was played, actually revealed his IP address. And they were able to find that out from his ISP and then prosecute and go from there. So I thought this was interesting, Emery, just because it's slightly different than the malware that we've talked about on the case before, right, where people who visited a certain site downloaded malware that then revealed their identities. So what do you think about this wrinkle?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, first off, it's absolutely true that the question of, can nation states break Tor is still up in the air. And, are you truly secure 100% anonymous on Tor? I don't think that anyone is saying that you are right now. But, right now in this specific case, what we're seeing, I think, is the best possible way that law enforcement could go about the investigation. This was unlike the malware cases where we've talked about before, where they place malware on an open website, allow it to anyone to download it. It could spread, it exploits, exploits that, the public may not be aware of. Here, what they did is they relied on a vulnerability of media players. They talked with the victim, they got a warrant for it, they specifically infected a single video file, uploaded it from the video file to the extortionist. They uploaded it specifically to the extortionist Dropbox. So they knew that only the victim and the extortionist would have access to the file. The file relied on the extortionist then opening it on their computer while connected to the internet, which revealed the IP address, which allowed them to move forward with the investigation. And I think we see something similar with the similar, but not entirely the same with the other sextortionist article that we have on notes today. But this is not the government wholesale breaking Tor or throwing nation state weight behind, some sort of exit node exploit where, the way Tor works is that obviously anyone can be an exit node, which gives it anonymity and, security. But it also means that if you have enough computers or enough money, you could just build enough exit nodes to sort of limit the, make it a little more easier for governments to be on the side that they can monitor your traffic. And that's not the case here. This is a targeted investigation. And I think that it sounds like a very well-built case.
Yeah, it does. And it's this is what you want to see law enforcement doing, actually working with victims and apprehending suspects. So,
and by the way, vilifying the technology, definitely Tor is used by sextortionists, but, I don't get the feeling that this is, a public attack on encryption technologies as much as it is, okay, well, this is a problem. We need to, get this bad guy. Let's do what we can to get this bad guy within the confines of the law. So good job.
Right. Exactly. Matt, anything to add here?
Yeah, no, I think you guys covered it well. I think this is a well-tailored attack on somebody's computer once they have committed a crime, and basically you're unveiling that the identity of someone who has already committed the crime is continuing to threaten someone with bodily harm. So I agree, and it's I think it's a well-tailored search and not a dragnet, and I think that's where the difference is.
Right. Yep. And the case we were referring to from 2013 had the FBI working with a specific, I guess, well-known child pornography website and saying, hey, you know, we're going to try and find users that were suspected of crimes by working with this website. It was just a much more broad kind of approach rather than we have one suspect in mind, we're working with a victim of that suspect, and we're trying to find out who this person is rather than just casting a really broad net. So this
good
seems
internet
like
beat cop work.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Good internet beat cop work. Similarly, and in other sextortion news, down in Florida, there was a woman who was subject to being sextorted by a couple of this is all, you know, allegations and under investigation, et cetera. But the people accused of sextorting her were reality TV stars. And together, their names are Hensha Voigt and Wesley Victor. And the victim here is Juliana Goddard, who goes by Yes Jules online. And apparently, in the course of this investigation, the police wanted to, similarly to the Riverside bombing suspect case, the police wanted to get at information that was on the suspect's iPhones, and they refused. They were not dead in this case. They actually refused. And so the question then remained, okay, well, can the police still get at the material on those phones? And what happened here was that the same third party that was suspected to have been involved in the San Bernardino County case, Celebrite got involved and did indeed open the phone and get at information that is now being used in this investigation. Are we concerned, guys, that police are deciding if you're not going to give us your phone passwords, we're just going to hire someone and get in there? And the courts are going to back that up. What do you think,
personally,
Emery?
I'm personally far more okay with that than trying mm-hmm. to go after the companies to tell them to unlock the phone or to break their own encryption or to build in back doors. You know, this is exactly very reminiscent of the San Bernardino case mm-hmm. where, you know, the person used the security measures on the iPhone and Apple justifiably said, I'm not going to undermine the security of all of my customers just because of this one person. And the law enforcement then went to a third party, just like if you had, a safe that you didn't want to unlock, they could go to a safe cracker and crack that door. I don't see that there's much of a problem here with going to third parties. I think that it's extremely expensive. So maybe we as taxpayers should be, you know, questioning whether or not we want to be paying for $6 million, exploits to iPhones. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is interesting here that I think does bear some thinking is that if I'm reading this correctly, I think that the phone was seized in 2015 and had been under lock and key since then. So even mm-hmm. though it was secured in 2015, basically what the law enforcement was able to do was just wait on the phone until an exploit was made public, because mm-hmm. none of these devices are perfectly secure. They may be secure right now, but, you know, given a couple of years, you never know what people will find. And I wonder if we're going to see that more frequently, in the future, because that does seem like a good option if I was trying to get at data inside of an iPhone and just hold off for a few years and then see what DEF CON turns up.
Right. I could certainly see defense lawyers having an issue with that, saying you're seizing our property and there's, you know, no good reason to hang on to that from us. Matt, any thoughts?
I think another interesting part of this article was whether the Fifth Amendment protects you from disclosing your passcode, and so whether a court can try to order you to disclose your passcode, or whether police can ask you for it. It seems to me that just in the nature of information that's locked in your head that's used as a passcode, it doesn't seem like there's any like good fine or fee that could be reasonable for getting that information. And so from a practical standpoint, it seems like the court should come down and say that, look, your passcode is protected, even though the result is that if they can get into it, they can get into it. It's kind of like, it's the lock and key analysis again. Like, what are they going to do to get out that information of where you hid your key? And so things stored in your head are it's just problematic to try to get them out. So I would like to see the court come out that way. But in terms of I think Emery's analysis was excellent on the ability of the government to get inside of that. His costly nature of getting into that is actually good for civil liberties, because it's just, even though they'll spend a lot of taxpayer money, it's not something they'll do all the time.
Right. What was the cost in this case? I remember seeing it in the article, but it's just not jumping out at me. It was like $1 million.
A million. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep,
$1 million.
It was $1 million to get into this phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't see law enforcement deciding to, take that step in every single case where there's possible evidence that could help their cause on a phone.
I do like the analysis, though, that holding it will become more of a normal thing, because once you crack it once, then the cost of doing it again goes down. And I would see firms dropping their cost more and more, if there's a competitive market for cracking this, so that it could come down. So that is an interesting analysis about, 5 years down the road, is something that happened in your original iPhone still going to be compromising you?
Yeah.
Right.
I think we question, these security firms that we're employing right now are, like, let's be honest, they're hacker mercenaries. They're not American necessarily. We don't necessarily know what other clients they've had, what other government clients they've had, whether other, terrorist clients they've had. Like, we don't know hardly anything about these companies. So it is, again, a public policy question, like, how okay are we with creating this market, Because I agree. It's there's definitely 100% a market for unlocking cracked or locked phones right now for law enforcement. 100%.
All right. Well, I think we have our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, which will be hacker mercenaries. we put these phrases in the show in case you are listening or watching for continuing legal education credit, something you're going to have to worry about soon here, Emery, or other professional credit in your field. We have some information for those of you out there who are lawyers. If you head to wiki.twit.tv and find our This Week in Law page there, there's some information about how you can go about submitting for credit in your jurisdiction of the United States. Hacker mercenaries is our first phrase. We'll put another one in before the show concludes. One other crime and justice story here in our rundown for this week has to do with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and whether it's legal to scrape a public website for information and use it under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act when the website owner has told you, no, we're not authorizing you to do that. This case is also pending in California. There's a split in the law about it, and it has to do with whether or not you've been told to knock it off or not. There's a case that involved Facebook. I remember talking about that case when it came out. that involve slightly different facts than this case, which involves LinkedIn. There's a small company called HiQ, and HiQ is being sued by LinkedIn under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. LinkedIn has told them, hey, we don't care if this information that you've been scraping is public. You're not authorized to get at it, and therefore we can sue you under this earlier precedent involving Facebook. Facebook told a, I think it was Power Ventures. They were using Facebook's login APIs to enable them to access people's friend lists and then go forward and try and get people to use what was called power.com, a social network that functioned like an aggregator where you could put all your social network information into one place. Facebook objected to that and sent a cease and desist letter. And the court in that case found that doing that was enough to make it unauthorized access of their information under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So here we have a slightly different set of parameters. We probably have in the LinkedIn terms of service something saying people may not scrape our site or, you know, use the various tools to get at the information on our site. I'm not sure if it says that or not, but whether it says that is going to be an issue in this case, I assume. But HiQ has been told to stop. So do they have to is the question that this case asks. And it's a really interesting question because here we're not talking about various technologies that are difficult to access, or you have to have a user granting you permission to access those functionalities of the site. We're talking about things where you can put in a URL and get the information. Scholars such as Oren Kerr think that that's really problematic. Kerr puts the example out there. What if you had, and here there's a good piece by Timothy Lee at Ars Technica if you want all of the details on this. But Oren Kerr is quoted there as positing the example of CNN sending out letters to reporters at rival news organizations demanding that their reporters not access CNN.com. Under an expansive reading of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, Oren Kerr fears that it could then become a federal crime to visit a public website. Is Oren Kerr being alarmist here? What do you think, Matt?
I don't think he's being alarmist. I think that when the definition of whether you're committing a crime or not is based on the contractual terms between you and another private party, those contractual terms can change. They are set by an agreement that you didn't read, and that you can be prosecuted for a federal crime for using that. It seems outside the bounds of justice that that's how a crime should be defined. Now, you know, in the common law, like you go back to property rights, and you can give access to one individual or not access to another individual. It is kind of hard to distinguish between, you know, theft, where you were borrowing your neighbor's plow, and then, you know, one day he says you can't use it anymore, and you borrow it again. And I guess that could be an analysis that you use for your access to another computer. But ultimately, this is an open. This is an open web forum, and the difference between this case and the Facebook case is that the other, the power.com was putting information onto the Facebook servers. And although I would like the Supreme Court to review that case, I think that it's distinguishable even within the Ninth Circuit to say that, look, these people are taking from LinkedIn information that's publicly available. They're not clouding up their servers in terms of putting data on there that they didn't want or anything like that. So I hope that's the way the court comes out.
Right. Scraping cases have been around since the inception of the internet, and people have never been happy about having their sites scraped. So it's not something new that we're seeing here. I think what's new is the prospect of it being a federal crime under the CFAA. We've had various other theories that have tried to block it in the past. And I'm kind of curious why the CFAA hasn't come up in this context before, because the law's certainly been around for a while. What do you think, Emery?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Matthew brought up some excellent points. I think that, you know, this shows off again what everyone has always said. The CFAA is bad law. It's just bad. Mm-hmm. you know, it's really overbroad. It's not very clear. To access a computer without authorization or exceed authorized access. You know, that being said, I think that you know, continuing to use a website after you've been issued a cease and desist letter clearly revokes any authorization you had to have it. Or I guess having a receiving a cease and desist letter clearly revokes that authorization. And so at that point, yeah, you would be using it, you know, unauthorized. And yeah, at that point, it would be a violation of the CFAA. Should it be, you know, no. But should the CFAA be changed? Yeah. But, you know, I don't think that Oren Kerr is being alarmist. I just think that he's probably taking this to the natural conclusion. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Right. There are some movements toward CFAA reform. Do you think it would be enough, Emery, to sort of tweak the language a bit to say, okay, a website's not a computer. A publicly available website just isn't what we had in mind when we enacted this law.
Maybe. I don't
Maybe.
Know. I'd have to think about that.
Yeah, no, but it certainly resides on computers and you know, that's the problem.
Yeah, so, you start doing that and you have the problems with the podcast patent case. You know, I mean, yeah. How many ways are we going to say that this is basically just a computer that does things? Stuff.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But before we leave this LinkedIn case, you guys probably aren't old enough to remember the Ticketmaster versus Tickets.com case, which involved a copyright issue, but it's got some weird parallels to this HiQ LinkedIn situation. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act did not come up in this 2000 case, Ticketmaster versus Tickets.com. But what did come up, California went through a period where we were having these trespass to chattels cases, which hasn't come up in a while, but again, could be something that comes up in this LinkedIn case, which looked at, if you're putting an undue burden on our web services or our servers that run our web services, then that can be problematic for you. But the interesting thing about this Ticketmaster case is the terms of service came up. The judge looked at the issue of whether if Ticketmaster had in its terms of service, hey, you can't scrape our site and get our information, that's not okay with us. So rather than sending a cease and desist letter, they just had it passively in their terms. And the judge said that was not open and obvious and hard. It was hard to miss because there was a link to the terms at the bottom of the homepage, like a lot of people do. And so, you know, it sort of triggers that what becomes an enforceable online contract issue. It was not a click-through agreement. It was a browse wrap agreement. And the judge there found, hey, if you're going to rely on your terms of service, this isn't sufficient. So I just thought it was an interesting echo in that this Facebook case and the LinkedIn case are both concerned with what people are being told about how they can use a website and what constitutes effective notice that you can't use it in a certain way. Any thoughts on that, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, this has come up in terms of more broadly in terms of federalism. When federal crimes, as part of the crime, have a state definition. So if you cross from Utah to Colorado, you'd have a different definition of what the crime is based upon which jurisdiction you're in. And judges have really disagreed over whether that gives proper notice using a genus and species type of law. I believe that they have ruled it unconstitutional in the terms of municipalities setting those, but they have okayed it in state by state jurisdictions. So that's why it's more difficult for me that a private company could set the underlying crime in the computer fraud and abuse case.
Right. Anything to add, Emery?
Nothing really. You know, I think that, you know, Matthew, when you brought it up originally, you know, the fact is that no one reads these things anyways. So any time we bring up the discussion of why are we still following rap contracts online, and will we ever actually acknowledge that these things are maybe the worst thing ever, as far as like getting consent and informing people about their rights and responsibilities, is a good thing. But yeah, it wasn't the case here, but I'm sure, like you said, that LinkedIn in their terms and conditions says that you can't use their data for anything outside of, you know, blah. But I don't think that putting that in bold with a nice heading wouldn't necessarily make it any more or less clear.
Right.
And there was some question.
Go ahead.
Sorry. There was some question of whether LinkedIn even owns the data. Is it
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, is it owned by the individual who put it up there, or is it owned by LinkedIn? I guess that's something I should have looked into, but I didn't.
Right, you know, and another issue that could rise from the dead from this Ticketmaster case is potentially the copyright issue. You know, who owns this data, and is it even datable that's capable of being owned? Which is what happened to Ticketmaster. The court found that what was being scraped and used wasn't even copyrightable. Interesting.
You own all the content, feedback, issues, and personal information you provide to us, but you also grant us a non-exclusive license to it. So, it does sound like it's owned by the users.
Right. Again, but back to the Ticketmaster issue, certain things, you know, just directory data, doesn't rise to the creativity level of even triggering copyrightability. So if you're putting, if what we're talking about are people's names and contact information, that's one thing. If what we're talking about is, you know, the flowery descriptions of what they're doing professionally, that might be another. So,
which I imagine is probably the case, to be honest, judging by the LinkedIn profiles I've read.
Yeah. All right. You mentioned the podcast patent. Let's get right to that, shall we? This has been going on for several years. We've been following it here on This Week in Law for several years, when Adam Carolla actually raised a ton of money, I think over $500,000, in a crowdfunded kind of way to battle this personal audio patent, and then wound up settling their claims.
I think there's a good Radiolab or Freakonomics episode about it as well. That's how I originally heard about it before law school.
Right. Well, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has finally driven the last nail into the coffin of the personal audio supposed patent in podcasting technology. Emery, you want to tell us what happened here?
I mean, as much as I can. I'm not a patent law expert, but I have taken a patent law class, so I'll do my best. The judge at this point basically affirmed the earlier ruling that the patent was both preempted and was obvious. So we have this – I don't know if he was necessarily like a patent troll and that he just held patents and didn't use them himself, or if he was trying to actually use this technology. I have to do a little more research. But basically, he had filed a patent for serially delivered audio broadcasts that were stored in a server, and then accompanying them was also some metadata that gave the description of the it's just radio over internet. You know, is the EFF made a very convincing argument that, you know, the idea of sending out audio files attached, you know, would necessarily, first of all, necessarily go through a server, necessarily be in the format of podcasts, and that it's really sort of obvious to anyone with any kind of expertise in, you know, audio production and computers and internet technology to try to couple the two of them. And also, the judge also ruled that it was preempted by an earlier patent on a different kind of episodic technology that I didn't really understand very well from his opinion. But what really stuck out is, the obviousness of this. And so now it's nail in the coffin. Don't have to deal with this.
Don't have to deal with it. EFF came in under a rule that it allows anyone to challenge the validity of a patent, not via a lawsuit, but with the Patent and Trademark Office itself. And that is the rule that they've ultimately prevailed under. There's an interesting standing issue involved in all this. Matt, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the standing issue is that typically under Article 3 of the Constitution, in order to get standing, it's required that there's a case or controversy. And in this case, what that typically involves is two parties. The original idea is that so someone has a tort and the other person committed the tort, and so those two people can bring claims against each other. But someone's you know, a third party can't just bring a claim in a normal suit. In this case, the EFF did not have grounds for standing. What they did is they went through the IPR proceedings, which was put together in the American Invents Act, which allows essentially third parties to challenge a patent through administrative procedure. What the mm-hmm. Federal Circuit said is that because the EFF was not – because they won the original suit and the suit brought up on appeal was brought by the opposing party, the original defendant, they did not have to have standing because they came through the administrative procedure. This actually seems like something that the Supreme Court could reverse because under a textual interpretation of the Constitution, that there is not a case or controversy. The leading cases on standing involve they say that there has to be a stake in the game. I believe that there's – I can't remember the name of the case, but it's about someone trying to enforce a – Endangered Species Act in another country, and they had to show some type of relationship to the endangered species in order to do that. So this is I've looked up some patent law review articles about this, and I think it's something to actually watch because I'm not sure that this would actually uphold. And it is important for administrative law if a law allows you to. If an administrative law allows you to get around the case and controversy requirement, that would actually be a big deal for jurisprudence.
Yeah, it sure would. All right. Well, good on you, EFF. It may not be the last nail in the coffin, right? Because personal
right,
audio can seek cert before the United States Supreme Court of this Federal Circuit decision. We will see if they decide to do that. This just came out on August 7th. So they have ample time to decide what they're going to do next. But for the time being, the podcasting patent remains something that podcasters don't have to worry about. So we will continue to hope that that remains the case. Let us move on to we haven't played our kids bumper in a long time, and we have the chance to do that this week. So let's talk about COPPA. I just love the music in that one. And of course, the children. Okay, so there is a new suit, a proposed class action lawsuit that has been filed in California. It's targeting the Disney company and, interestingly, three other software companies, Upsite, Unity, and Kochava, alleging that the apps the four of them built together violate COPPA. By gathering insights about app users across the internet, including those under the age of 13, in ways that facilitate commercial exploitation of the data. So they're arguing that the requirements of COPPA, which requires you to give notice if you are targeting children under the age of 13 with your services, you have to give notice of what information you are collecting, how you're collecting it, who you're sharing it with, and you have to get parental consent if you are doing anything that involves personal information of those under the age of 13. So it's something that Disney is well versed in. And I think if you're going to pick a company to go after for this, Disney is a great big target. You better have a great big gun to come after them with, and be sure that they're playing fast and loose with COPPA, because you know they have whole legal teams devoted to complying with those regulations. The interesting wrinkle here is that we're talking about mobile apps. And really, really popular ones that have been, for example, Where's My Water has been installed between 100 million and 500 million times.
I can't believe that. I tried playing that game last night, and it is a thinly veiled commercial wrapped in like a reskinned like Flash game from 15 years ago. It's bizarre that's 500 million times. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Kids spend a lot of time on these apps. And I think parents, you know, in general, when you're downloading from someone like Disney, you feel pretty good about, or you'd like to feel pretty good about the fact that, you know, your child is not being targeted with marketing or targeted location wise, and, you know, that their privacy is being respected. You can see the full list of apps subject to the lawsuit in the Washington Post piece that we linked to in our discussion points. I see at least three on there that have been in use in my household in the past. I'm wondering how far back this lawsuit goes to, you know, who the potential class members might be, because we might be one. Crossy Road is on there, plus a couple of Star Wars ones that I've seen pop up on our devices, Droids Commander and Star Wars Commander and Star Wars Puzzle Droids. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure lots of parents would see apps on here that they might think they might be in the class as well, or they're, you know, on behalf of their children, they might be in the class. But what's really interesting here to me is the Disney as a defendant, obviously, you know, you better have your Donald Ducks in a row if you're going to go after them. But also these three software developers. And it may well be that the case doesn't go anywhere because the plaintiffs have cast too broad a net here. You have to be targeting children. And I think, you know, the apps in question here, it's hard not to say that they're targeting children. But the software developers are what make this really interesting to me, because I think if this case is allowed to go forward and these folks allowed to be in the crosshairs, and if there's ultimately liability against them, then I think the whole realm of online advertising is going to have to quake in its boots. One of the things pointed out in the argument or in the article here is a quote from Jeffrey Chester, who's the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. He says Disney should not be using those software development companies. They are heavy duty technologies, industrial strength data and analytic companies whose role is to track and monetize individuals. These should not be in little children's apps. Well, you could flip that on its head and say, if you know that you're working with someone like Disney who's targeting little children, you should not be doing those practices. So I really think that there's some interesting nuances to this case, and it's going to be one to watch. What do you think, Matt?
I don't know that much about COPPA, so I don't know that I can provide that much substantively. I do think it'd be interesting in terms of discovery. One of the qualifications for getting 23B3 class certification, which is the kind of class certification they would need to get damages, is that they are actually able to provide notice. Typically in a class action suit, you get that notice through discovery from the other party. And if they're not able to disclose the information about who their clients are under COPPA, that'll be an interesting rabbit hole to go down legally. But I don't know enough about COPPA to really provide anything else.
That's an interesting question.
They can always get permission to disclose. And then even if permission is granted, they could put something in place where the information's not publicly available. It's under seal with the court.
But I think still, that actually allows for disclosure for, you know, if they're required to by the court. It could be incorrect. Okay. I know that almost every children's privacy policy I've seen includes that, you know, we may disclose if we're ordered to by the court.
Right. What do you think about this, Emery?
Yeah, I mean, I have thoughts, I guess. you know, Disney, obviously, if you're going to be coming up against Disney, you would think that Disney of all companies would be able to. I mean, first of all, we know that Disney obviously has world-class lawyers, and I'm looking through their privacy policy, it's well-crafted, and you would assume that Disney would be very careful not to run afoul of COPPA, considering, you know, what they are and who they sell to. But at the same time, it also doesn't surprise me at all that Disney would want to, you know, be right up to the edge of compliance. Because obviously this data is extremely valuable. As you said, you know, these apps have been downloaded 100 to 500 million times sometimes. You know, our newer generation just absolutely like glued to their tablet. And for example, I downloaded about four or five of these apps last night just to go through the account creation process, just to see what it looks like if I say that I'm under 12, to see how quickly I can sort of go from taking my parents' iPad to playing this game with an online profile that's, you know, tracking the, you know, what advertisements I click on and how I use the app. And yeah, you know, if I had a child, I would be concerned. In every case, I was able to go through completely from, you know, opening the app to playing it with, you know, creating an account without any real sort of parental oversight or parental consent. COPPA requires, you know, before a company collects information from a child that they, you know, try to get the parent's consent. And, you know, the extent of that for Disney's apps, as far as I can tell, is when the child is creating an account, if it says that if they say that they're under 13, then they have to put in their parents' email address, and that's it. You know, there's no sort of verification email sent to that email address to say, you know, you're the parent, do you consent or do you verify that your child is okay to play this? You know, nothing. It just says that's the parent's email on file. At the same time, you are getting the child's first and last names and their birthday. You're getting, you know, the whether they click on advertisements or not, you're getting how they're using the app itself. Looking at Disney's privacy policy, you know, it certainly reads like it's in compliance with COPPA. It says that they don't hold on to children data for longer than is reasonably necessary to provide the services. And that, you know, if they collect any information outside of COPPA, then, you know, they will immediately delete it or ask for immediate consent from the parent. But, you know, personally, in my experience with it, I found that process lacking. You know, I got an email this morning, not last night when I created the account, that my child, quote unquote, was playing an online game. And by the way, when you know, one of the other requirements for COPPA is that, you know, the privacy policy be prominently displayed. You know, it's not enough to have just a tiny link at the bottom of your website. You know, when you're going through the process, it should tell you affirmatively, you know, what are the privacy policies, what kind of data we collect, when do we collect it, how do we share it. And in all of the apps that I tried, that was, you know, it was difficult to get to the privacy policy. There was, you know, a window that popped up that said that there are now you know, in-game purchases, and that's purchased with real money on your parents' real wallet, so be careful before you buying that. But yeah, you know, I usually had to go into the settings, click on legal documents, click on privacy policy. It opened up an external link, which took me out of the game and brought me to another website, that I don't think that a child would be able to comprehend. So yeah, it's something to follow. And the point you brought up about, you know, standing for, you know, maybe upending the advertising industry, I think that's super exciting. I hadn't thought about that. You know, whether these other, companies that are building these services for Disney share any of that responsibility. You know, like I said, with Where's My Water 2, it is honestly an advertising machine. Like, you open up the app and you're presented with a video advertisement, literally a commercial for children's toys with children, you know, running around and shooting, like, you know, little plastic toys at each other. And then you get to the screen and then you press new game and you're presented with another commercial, and then you play through a level and then you're presented with another commercial, and it goes on like that. So there's definitely, you know, there's definitely advertisements being put on those devices. I'm interested as far as So the thoughts that I had were that, you know, these accounts that they're building, if they are complying with CABA, then they can't really be tracking that advertisement profile for the children until they, you know, reach the age of 13. But, you know, given that Disney is a century-year-old corporation, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, they're basically priming them just so that as soon as they reach the age of 13, they're able to start collecting this data. Or if, you know, for the children that are 12 or under, are they just basically throwing at them the standard block of non-targeted but children-directed advertisements that, you know, they don't necessarily need to know that I particularly like Iron Man. They just happen to know that every 12-year-old boy likes Iron Man. It'd be interesting to see what comes up with this.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a super interesting case to watch. COPPA is difficult. It's as we've pointed out in the past, something that the world of mobile apps approaches differently and probably not as well as the rest of the web. Yeah. So, you know, whether that's the chink in the armor here or the fact that just, you know, what's being done is not being properly disclosed and consented to.
Annoyingly, when they take the parents' email address and their privacy policy, they say, oh, you know, we're taking this email address solely so that we can, you know, contact you to get consent if anything happens, but we're not going to use it for any marketing purposes unless, of course, you happen to already be a Disney member or any other kind of app, and then we're totally, definitely going to be marketing to you.
Totally and definitely. Yeah. All right. Any final thoughts, Matt?
Nope. I just totally and definitely marketing to you. That could be in the show.
Yeah, that should be our second MCLE passphrase, right? We are so totally and definitely marketing to you. So there it goes.
I'm glad to have contributed to the show notes.
Yes, definitely. Where were we going to go after this? We were going to talk about speech and the First Amendment, I believe. So we can't really ignore the story of the week, which has to do with the former employee of Google who published a memo that was very controversial and got him fired, a software engineer who said some very I already said controversial, but difficult things in a open memo at not an open memo. This was actually an internal memo at Google, but it was available to various employees. His last name, I'm not sure how to pronounce. It's either Damore or Damore. But by now you've probably caught wind of it. Hopefully read the memo. You've certainly probably read coverage of the memo, and we bring it up on This Week in Law because we like to seize on opportunities, and this is just such a one, to point out that the First Amendment doesn't work the way a lot of people think that it works. Oftentimes, people think that they have, you know, the absolute right to say what's on their mind in whatever way, in whatever forum, and that's a valued protection that we have in the United States. And that's not how the First Amendment works. What we have here is somebody speaking in the context of their job. It matters very much whether he was an at-will employee or an employee who was under contract. That has to do with under what circumstances he can be fired. If he was hired at will, that means you don't need any reason. You could decide you don't like the cut of his jib in any way to let him go as an employee. As long as he's not in a protected class, right. You can't do discriminatory things to an at-will employee, but it does not appear that that's what happened here. And then also, even if he is under employment contract with Google, you could still let him go for cause. And if you are talking about somebody who's creating either violating Google's internal policies, which it seems he may have done here, or creating a situation where Google could be sued by other workers who considered the substance of this memo creating a hostile work environment, then he could be let go for cause for those reasons or other reasons. So,
or if you know this guy happened to give any monthly review, annual reviews to women, and mm-hmm. it turns out that he was not the kind of person to be, doing that with, in good faith, this is the other thing that could bring liability on Google.
Right. There are sort of two prongs of the memo that he submitted. One is, he feels that, the diversity initiatives at Google are not, operating properly, that they are disadvantaging certain employees in ways that they should not be. And then he went on to talk about how women biologically are different from men. And either one of those things could be problematic. The second one, certainly more so. There is a legal wrinkle here in favor of Damore. He did lodge a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board before he was fired, and he may be able to say that his dismissal was somehow related to his complaints about working conditions and find some protection under the NLRB there. So it's not completely cut and dried. There's a very nice piece at by Alexia Hernandez Campbell at Vox that sort of lays out all of the legal procedural aspects of this, both on the Google side and on the former employee side. So if you're interested in the particulars of that, I recommend that piece. I personally don't think that Google has much to worry about here. Engineers at Google are non-union. If he was a union employee, this could be more problematic for Google, but that's not the case. So just one of those instances. Number one, we wanted to point out, again, don't think the First Amendment covers all speech because it doesn't. And secondly, that robots may next turn their laser focus on humanity and begin saying that they are much more capable of writing music and otherwise performing tasks that we traditionally have done, and that perhaps we are not the ideal employees that they would make. I'm alluding to the fact that there's a wonderful piece of satire at McSweeney's, which if you're not already reading, will brighten your day immensely if you start doing so. It's a piece titled, "I'm a Google Manufacturing Robot, and I believe humans are biologically unfit to have jobs in tech." So
I do want to say that I find the term meat sacks derogatory, and it does create an unsafe working environment.
It's very hostile.
So I would object to that term.
Exactly.
I think another thing to note here is, yes. All of you starry-eyed millennials that want to go work in Silicon Valley, remember, you're probably going to be at will. Basically, you're probably going to be an at will employee everywhere you go. And to keep that in mind, at will means you can be fired at will.
Right. The other thing that just came to mind in seeing all the coverage and reaction to this story is we cover so many times people who get fired for what they post on social media. And we try and, let people know that you better be careful what you're posting on social media, because it can certainly come back and impact negatively your ability to keep your job. And I think that Google would have been in a fine position to terminate this guy if he had simply posted it on social media and not in a workplace context. They probably have even more basis for letting him go, for this being a for cause kind of dismissal if he's doing this in a workplace context. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, and the third point of maybe why he was fired is that it was a 3,300 word essay on it. Mm-hmm. Like, it just kind of shows like, I just do not recommend writing a 3,300 page memo on anything unrelated to work at work.
I'm sure that every tech company encourages their workers to, you know, have that sort of hour or 3 hours or however long during the week to work on your own independent projects. And I encourage you to work on your independent projects that are not discriminatory screeds against your fellow coworkers.
Right. Absolutely. I guess the coda to this that hasn't gotten quite as much coverage, it just happened yesterday, is that Jeffrey Lord got let go from CNN, not for posting some sort of internal memo, but for something that he tweeted. And it is, it's not something that was pulled off Twitter caused any sort of suspension of his account, but he was having sort of a heated online exchange. And in his effort to characterize someone as a fascist, his rejoinder was "See Kyle," and CNN and it came out and said, "Nope, sorry, that shall not pass, and we're not going to continue our relationship with Jeffrey Lord." So, you know, just another example of. Well, first of all, it's an example of, I think, Godwin's law coming into play. As Shani Jardin tweeted, "Wait a minute, CNN fired Jeffrey Lord? Wow, I did not see that coming." Godwin's law in action, and also just, you know, you what you have to say on social media is definitely being taken into account by your employers, and if they feel it's problematic, they may well let you go.
Opinions are my own, I think will very quickly go the way of the dodo and will not be seen as this sort of rubber stamp. Anything I say on Twitter is okay and can't touch me at work.
Right. Exactly. Anything to add, Matt?
Nope.
Okay. What else did we have under First Amendment? Interesting decision came out, not involving the president, but involving a different local county politician. It was a federal court in Virginia that looked at the issue of whether that person, this involved Facebook, could block people from his Facebook page, her Facebook page, chairwoman of the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors. The plaintiff there was named Brian Davison, and he had been banned from the chairwoman's Facebook page. The court found that the chairwoman was using her Facebook page, even though it was, you know, it could have been used in a personal, non-work way. It was being used as part of her role as chairwoman of the County Board of Supervisors, and that to block the guy was depriving him of having interaction with an elective official, that it was viewpoint discrimination, which the First Amendment protects. So she was there acting in her government capacity, by the court found, by blocking this person on Facebook, and that was a First Amendment no-no. So I bring it up because people are wondering about Twitter users blocked by President Trump. Do you see a parallel here? Does it matter what platform you're on, Emery, and the fact that even if your account has been blocked by President Trump, you can still see what he's tweeted? It's more public than Facebook is. Do you think that matters?
I am so torn on this. I don't know if I have a satisfying answer at all. You know, It does sound on its face like viewpoint discrimination, but on the other hand, it's a non-public forum that's never necessarily been held open as a public forum. It's a private account on a private website. I don't know. I'm interested to hear what are your thoughts, and Matthew's as well.
I think the fact that you could still, even if you're blocked as a user, so if you're logged into your account You may not be able to see what he's tweeted, right? Because that's technologically how it works. If you're logged in and you're blocked, then you can't see. But if you log out and you go to twitter.com/realDonaldTrump, you can still at least see what's going on there. You can't take part in the discussion.
Take part in the speech, though.
Yeah. And that may be the rub of it.
And that was the analysis that I read through the opinion in the district in Virginia, and what it was concerned with was the ability to comment on a public forum. The way that Donald Trump's Twitter, not his presidential Twitter account, but his personal or it not yeah, so the real or whatever his Twitter account is, I don't know, and I'm very glad I don't know.
Well, he's got POTUS.
POTUS one would probably fall under the same analysis as this, because what the court looked at was looking at whether this county official acted under the color of law, and a large part of the analysis was based on the fact that she started this Facebook account the day after she became the county commissioner or whatever it was. So that she used her chief of staff to organize this, and therefore moreover she asked for public comment and for criticism and all of this. And then right after this gentleman came into a meeting and complained, she preemptively disconnected his account for 12 hours or something. Under this analysis, because Donald Trump has been going on and saying obnoxious things for years and years on Twitter, that would be one way to distinguish this. But we'll have to wait and see. Obviously, this is just a lower court decision and it is not binding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting bit of law unfolding there, and possibly with larger ramifications. Also, Matt, you pointed out this interesting bit of advertising going on in New York City concerning Airbnb. And I'm putting it in our First Amendment discussion because I'm wondering the extent to which commercial speech may offer protection to the hotel industry here if someone were to come down on them regulatorily or legislatively to say that what they're doing is crosses a line and shouldn't be done. And what they're doing is running television ads. Are they television ads? I think they're television ads. 30-second ads. Again, these are sponsored by the NYC Hotel Association. They've spent nearly $500,000 to run ads for 10 days. Yeah, during morning and evening television spots on major networks like CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. And what they're basically trying to convey through their ads is that Airbnb and services like it are bad because of the terror threat in New York City, and you don't know who your neighbor may be renting their home out to. And the guy next door who's renting via Airbnb or elsewhere may be a terrorist. And they want to plant that seed of fear and, you know, get people to crack down on these home sharing, home rental services that compete with the New York City hotel industry. Airbnb has come out and pointed out Airbnb spokesman Peter Schottenfels told the Daily News that the terrorists responsible for the 9/11 attacks in NYC and the 2015 Paris attacks, by the way, stayed in hotels. So their very point seems to be subverted by that. But what do you think, Matt? Are they maybe crossing a line here with these ads?
I mean, they're certainly crossing a line. I think that these ads are just horrendous in terms of their fear mongering. But I do think the First Amendment would protect him in this instance. Because what they're doing is New York is has a proposed law that's going to not allow individuals to stay within an Airbnb. So they're providing public discussion, although horrible public discussion and quite frankly useless public discussion about the value of Airbnb for the city of New York. So this is very similar to Citizens United, where there was a video about Hillary Clinton that these individuals were not allowed to play. It was a corporation that was not allowed to play 90 days before the before the election. I believe that it was her Senate election. And so this seems very analogous, that this is it's public comment and public criticism about a proposed law. So the typical commercial speech analysis, I don't think would apply, and it would fall within the political commercial speech.
Emery, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, if it doesn't fall under the political commercial speech, then the first prong of the commercial speech analysis is whether it's protected speech, which requires that it not be false or misleading. So, I mean, I think there's an interesting question of whether or not this is misleading, given that it is trying to incorrectly connect, you know, home sharing services to terrorist bombers receiving packages. But yeah, I think if I was a betting man, I'd probably say that it's protected speech.
Yep. So as far as we know,
it's gross, though. God, yeah.
Terrible.
Anything that invokes terrorism or protecting the children is automatically gross, and this definitely.
All right, we need a unicorn chaser of some kind.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Matt? Before we go.
I just find it amazing that people wanting you to sleep in their beds have put this out as an advertisement. Like, it's just astounding to me.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other legal foot may drop on this. I don't know. It's one to pay attention to. I think it was a good catch, Matt. I'm interested in what happens here. I don't know if this constitutes as a unicorn chaser, but we'll talk about some wedding photos. That can't be too unpleasant, right? Social wedding. It actually can be pretty unpleasant. What happens here is this is sort of a cautionary tale of, again, you know, everyone has an online presence these days, and what that means, again, what sort of speech you can engage in online with impunity. The defendants here certainly thought that they could be fast and loose with the facts in writing about their experience with a wedding photographer. The wedding photographer, though she in the meantime had to engage in years of litigation and had her business unravel in the process, was ultimately vindicated. So this happened in Dallas, Texas. And there was a blogger named Neely Moldovan and her husband, Andrew, who had hired a wedding photographer and had a dispute with the photographer about what photos they had received and whether they needed to pay more to get their wedding album and have the entirety of their photos presented to them. Also interesting here is one of the things that seemed to be a big bone of contention between the parties here is that the photographer held on to the high definition digital copies of the wedding photos until full payment and the album had been generated. And you know, this was disclosed to the people here, and nevertheless, they made use of the low definition photos as soon as they were provided with them. So that's an interesting wrinkle in the case. Is you know, how authorized are you to make use of things before your entire contract with the photographer has been concluded. And then they got upset. They got upset that they weren't getting their high definition photos. They wanted to make use of those too. They did not pay the extra fee that they needed to pay. And when all of that happened, they took to the bride's blog and they took to local television to say that their wedding photos had been held hostage. Well, the photographer had a very different take on all this and documentation to back her up, and she sued. And lo and behold, she recently won that suit and recovered over, well, she has a judgment that says she can recover over $1 million in damages. So now the bride and groom are sort of stunned. They feel like, gee, we did exactly what, you know, consumer advocates tell you to do. We had a problem. We complained online, and now we're being told to pay $1 million in damages. But what's the moral of this story, Emery?
Read your contract, read your contract, read your contract. Maybe talk to a lawyer if you don't want to read a contract, because it's important. And also, consumer advocacy, like, I'm all about it. It's great. Complain online. If your job is to talk about things online and you might want to be careful about, say, inviting NBC to, you know, come to your apartment so you can exaggerate the story about what actually happened. And yeah, you know, there are repercussions for just saying things that are straight up wrong and didn't happen and going after a woman's business for it.
Right. And Andrea Polito, the photographer, though she's been vindicated through this lawsuit and has the ability to recover damages, who knows, you know, whether there's, you know, an actual ability to make good on that judgment or, you know, so in the meantime, her business has been decimated. This is all, if you're a wedding photographer, you get your referrals through word of mouth. And if all the word of mouth on you is that you're holding people's photos hostage and not turning them over after they've paid you, that's going to be problematic for your business. Matt, anything you want to add?
I think that Emery covered it. Tell the truth and, read the contract.
Also, yeah. I think Polito is to believe 100%, then she says that, and I probably would believe her, given that I know how these sort of small businesses operate, is that they, you know, when they were signing up for the service, they almost certainly told her that this was the case, that you have to, that we're not going to give you the high definition photos until after the album is delivered, that the album has a cover fee. You know, she says that it's bold and underlined in their contract, and that she went over it with him in person. It seems very likely that they would have done that. Tell the truth. Tell the truth. Don't do it for the clicks. The clicks aren't worth it. The karma isn't real.
Right. And as the Washington Post reports here, apparently knowing that she was dealing with a bride who had an online presence, she told her studio manager, she's a blogger, make sure everything looks perfect.
Yeah.
So she was aware that there could be public discussion of her work. I don't think she probably ever anticipated that the public discussion of her work was going to put her out of business. It doesn't give, you know, just because you have an online presence doesn't give you the ability or the right to bully the people that you deal with, and there could be ramifications from that, and that seems to be what happened here. Sort of restores people's faith. Here's the unicorn chaser aspect of it. Restores your faith in the jury system, that a jury could look at all this and reach a decision that assisted the photographer. So
I wonder if those damages will stand, though. I'm not with those kind of damages, they have to be, you know, estimated to like a reasonable certainty. I took the bar like weeks ago, so excuse me if a little bit of it has dribbled out of my ear.
dribbled out of your mouth, I think.
yes. Yeah, you know, I'm sure that she suffered probably in excess of a couple hundred grand worth of damage to her business, but it will be interesting to see if that stands. I mean, $1 million is a lot.
That's right.
For a $125 fee dispute.
Exactly. Where else did I have? Yeah, you know what? I meant to throw in before the end of the show here. Sorry, Victor, I didn't give you this bumper, but since we're talking about social web, we can just put it under that rubric. Did you guys see that Pokemon Go Fest had its own fire festival kind of event and is now facing a lawsuit?
Oh man, I hope fire festival becomes like an adjective or like a verb even.
Yes, they have been fire festivaled. They have fire festival. The fire festival Pokemon. So just to briefly recap, there is a class action lawsuit that is pending. For people who attempted to attend Pokemon Go Fest and were upset by the fact, by the way, can I just pause for a moment to reflect on how last year at this time we were all obsessed completely with Pokemon Go. Now we're just kind of laughing at the people who went to Pokemon Go Fest. No, I'm sorry.
They should have been as hard as they physically can be rolled.
Yes, exactly. Apparently things did not go as planned at Pokemon Go Fest. There were glitches and problems that the people who attended were compensated for. Niantic offered full refunds for tickets. All visitors also received a $100 in-game credit. That buys you a lot in Pokemon Go, as I recall, as well as they got the legendary Pokemon that they were supposed to get for attending the event. But that wasn't enough for the people who've gone ahead and filed a class action. A lot of them did travel from out of town and had expenses that they expected to be, well,
their while.
Again, is this a read your contract? We could have technical difficulties.
This is ridiculous. I mean, every music festival in history has had some band bail out at the last minute. Like every event that has ever issued, ticket or refunds for tickets, they're not going to cover your travel expenses to get there. Like the goal of damages in this case is just to put you in the case that you would have been had everything gone great. And guess what? Right. You got the refund for the ticket. You got $100 bonus in-game currency. You got the Pokemon that you wanted. Like, I cannot believe that any law firm took this on. Like, this just sounds so ridiculous.
Yes.
And moreover, in order to have a class action, you have to be able to calculate the damages. And why a class action would be the best suited method for determining, various travel expenses and hotel expenses. That just seems like a waste of the court's time.
Yeah.
I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, if the only thing I expect to hear more about this is sanctions. Otherwise, like, what?
What? All right. Well, we'll have to monitor and see if anybody gets sanctioned for filing this lawsuit. But I just, the marriage of Fire Festival and Pokemon Go Fest seemed like one that we needed to acknowledge. And with that, we'll move on to our animal selfie of the week. We'll go ahead and let you enjoy our animal selfie of the week bumper. Guys, I think this one adds a new wrinkle, and that PETA may want to, consider. Not that they shouldn't settle the case that they brought, but just one for them to put in their files for future plaintiff fodder. I'll just play it for you, and we can talk about it as it's playing. Okay, so we had an eagle last week. We once again have an airborne eagle where the eagle is both cinematographer and in the footage. We see the eagle's head here. And actually,
that's amazing.
I should have, this is a 360-degree video.
Oh,
so
cool.
You can actually see more of the eagle if you'd like, right?
We may be able to identify this eagle then.
That's right. We're flying over the Dolomites in Italy here. I think there's some affiliation with Red Bull with this video. And I'm sure PETA would not be happy with the fact that the eagle is being strapped into a harness and made to fly over the Dolomites. But it seems to be having a nice time.
I wonder if 360 video brings even more of a wrinkle into the idea that this could be sort of the animal's creation, because it's not at all
That's what I was about to bring up. So I just chose this angle. So does that give me a? I'm just kidding.
No, but you're onto something here.
I think you should make a neural network program for the things that PETA is upset about, Emery.
I did. Yeah. Well, we'll see. I might publish something.
Right. Now back to our discussion about machines creating things and animals creating things. And here we have 360 video where the viewer has a participatory role in what's being displayed. What does that all mean? And does it mean, as Wikimedia Commons would have it, that if the animal is the videographer, there is no copyright? I don't know, but I thought this was a really interesting and gorgeous bit of video. So that's our animal selfie of the week for you. Our resource of the week has to do with, we already mentioned, the neural nets that Emery has been occupying himself with since the bar.
Yay, unemployment.
Yay. His law firm name generator neural net is really fun and funny. I would think if you are, you know, obviously if you're forming a law firm and you need a good name, this would be a great way to try and come up with one.
Maybe you don't want to have your own last name. Maybe you want to just have a sort of law firmy sounding name. Or maybe you're making a D&D campaign and you need some business names. Yes. Let Finord and Elling serve you, or Fing Pat Ertl, or Veltrubi and Fulins. I also like Voy.
I like Voy a lot.
Yeah.
Voy seems like it should already be a company name of some kind.
It might be.
Yes. Of course, if you're, a legal drama, legal thriller author in training, this would be a great way to come up with your law firm names for your fiction or your movie.
I posted some longer lists on GitHub that I think I linked to in that article. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You know, you feed your little neural net data and you can just add a zero to the parameter, to the, you know, output parameter, and suddenly you have like a 100,000 names. It's
right. And you were inspired by the great, I remember this from about a month or so ago. Someone did the same thing with paint colors.
Yeah, Janelle Shane, she's actually on her blog. She has a number of different neural net projects, new paint colors invented, new like Crayola crayons. There was also a really good one about Dan Hahn made a neural net that spat out British sounding county names, which is great. I actually want to do one similar to Louisiana parishes. I feel like I could have something fun. And then also I used my MacBook. If you have any experience whatsoever in the terminal, if you're comfortable, you know, poking around in there, definitely check out, and you're interested in this stuff, check out Jeff Thompson's tutorial. I linked to that on the blog post as well in the first paragraph. And it holds our hand and walks you through it, and it'll teach you how to use it. And if you've got a lot of time because you're post-barred and unemployed right now, I encourage you to check it out.
I don't know if it has to do with your current state in life deal. Yes, the ordeal that you've just been through. Obviously, you're playing around with neural nets, does, but I was just going to say that I felt like throughout this show, Emery, you're channeling a bit. You're sort of physically channeling a young Will Wheaton.
I'll take it. Sure.
That's just me. And you're naming a podcast neural net is going to be, you're going to do a post about that soon,
yeah,
right?
That should come up this weekend. Please check it out. I think it'll be fun.
Great. And then, our tip of the week would be, again, something for PETA to file away if it is, in fact, going to settle the monkey selfie lawsuit and it is looking for future ways to sue in similar fashion. There's this really interesting scholarly piece about whale songs, humpback whale songs in particular, and how whale songs seem to sample one another. And in fact, that's how new whale songs are generated. So
everything's a remix.
Everything's a remix. So PETA could either represent the whales against people who want to monetize their songs, or against one another when the sampling is too extensive, you know, a la some of the various music cases, Blurred Lines, etc., that we've discussed on the show in recent years. So our tip of the week is for PETA. Look to the whales. They may be your next lawsuit. With that, we'll go ahead and conclude this episode of This Week in Law. This very family-oriented, Twill family-oriented episode. It's been so great to have both of you on. Matt, how's it going in D.C. these days?
I am back in South Bend now, and we will be doing an episode now that I'm back and not so crazy busy on the patent standing issue this week. So
great.
Go check out LawPint.
Yes. You're doing an episode of LawPint. You needed to plug the actual show.
I know. It's been a while since I've done one, so the plugging was not required.
Great. That's wonderful. Have you started school again yet?
I start in a week or so, something like that. So soon enough.
All right. Best of luck. And Emery, we're so glad to have you risen from the dark recesses of studying for the bar and coming out into the light again.
I am so glad to be back. It's it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me, as always. The chat, it's been great talking with you guys. I hope to be back on again sometime when Mike gets back. I really missed out. We missed out on some really awesome Dr. Seuss Star Trek talk that I'm sorry, listeners, you'll just have to hold on to for next time. But
hold on to your tall, curvy hats, because we will have some good Dr. Seuss Star Trek stuff for the next time Mike is on, which will hopefully be next week. We do record this show. We're talking about Mike Keyes, who's my other regular co-host here on the show. We record every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So try and join us if you can. We'd love to have you join us live, but don't worry if you can't. If you go to twit.tv/twill, then you're going to find our whole archive of shows there. It's fun to dive back into them and see, oh my gosh, they were talking about the CFAA way back when, and it's still a big issue. And because some of these issues are sort of evergreen. They come back around just in different forms. So it's kind of neat to track through and see what was going on, what is going on, and of course what will be going on in the future, hopefully when you join us for future shows. And when you do, we hope to have your input on those shows by getting in touch with us. You can find all of us on Twitter. Our Twitter handles have been up throughout the show, but in case you're listening to audio only, I'm D Howell there. Matt is LawPint there, and Emery is Emery Roan there. So that's a great place to get in touch with us. Let us know what you thought, things that you've spotted there or elsewhere that you want to get links in front of us. Or you can just go ahead and email us. We all have emails that you can reach us at. Matt is mattc@twit.tv. Emery is emery@twit.tv. I am denise@twit.tv. So let us know via email what you're watching or thinking about.
You can also reach me at hello@emeryr.info. My address down on the bottom third.
Like it. Hello@emeryr.info. We love to hear from you guys. We love getting wonderful tidbits like our AI-generated music via listener Ken H. in this episode. Really love hearing from you folks and what you think would be interesting for us to discuss further on the show, and about who you think we should have on the show. Always looking for interesting people, scholars, journalists who traffic in these sorts of issues. We'd love to get them on and get to know them better too. So keep us posted and keep on doing well. We will see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.